Welcome to the One-Off Technology Podcast for your hosts, Roy Richardson and Chuck Breek. Each episode brings discussions about technology topics in the news and how they affect you. If you're curious and want to know more, sit back, listen, and enjoy the show. How you doing? Hey, and welcome to the One-Off Technology Podcast. And for those that have been counting at home, this is episode 5, and this is part 2. And the reason episode 5 had a part 2 is because it was supposed to be a Raspberry Pi episode where we also talked about 3D printing. And it wound up, part 1 wound up being, well, a 3D printing episode. And so now I'm lucky to have two awesome guests on today. Who are going to talk about an amazing Raspberry Pi project they did. And so the episode finally lives up to the moniker of being a Raspberry Pi podcast. And so I want to welcome both of my guests today, Julie and Carlos. If you don't mind, how about brief introductions?
Certainly. Well, my name's Carlos Unda. I'm a physics student at Erskine College. I'll be graduating in December. And moving on into the professional world, looking into manufacturing opportunities.
All right. My name is Julie Butler. I am triple majoring in physics, chemistry, and mathematics at Erskine College. I'll be starting my junior year, and after college, I plan on going into physics grad school.
Wow. I was going to say, you only left, like, English. What's the other major at Erskine now? Okay. No, I'm just kidding. That's awesome. So you guys put together a project, and as I understand it, Carlos, this was for a company that you may have been doing an internship for, that you work for, and what was the problem you were trying to solve, and what can you tell us about that project?
Well, it's not so much for the company, but it is addressing an issue that they had, are still having, actually. So they have a very complex system of PLCs and HMIs. PLCs being programmable logic controllers, and HMI, human machine interfaces. The job that these devices do is to essentially be given instructions by a human and then control hardware accordingly through signals. And it's very expensive, and it's not really that easy to work with. It's overcomplicated. And so the inspiration for applying Raspberry Pis came from that. And that's just from previous experiences that Julie and I had both had in controlling devices through the general purpose input-output pins that the Raspberry Pis have. So it's true that we did target an issue that this company was having, but not for the company.
Okay.
This is more than anything, it was for our entertainment, just to see if we could do what a $1 billion company could do for, you know, $40.
Right.
Which turned out to be yes.
Okay.
But I think that it really proved the usefulness of Raspberry Pis and learning on a Raspberry Pi what you can do with it. It's pretty incredible.
Now, what made you choose the Raspberry Pi over other board devices like Arduino and Beagle and that type of thing? Was it the price point, or did you even consider other devices? Or,
well, the main thing was we already had a Raspberry Pi cluster.
Okay. I was going to ask you about that later, because Zach, who introduced me to these two, told me about that you had also created a Raspberry Pi cluster. I'm interested in that. We'll come back to that. So which Raspberry Pi device, which model of the Raspberry Pi have you guys been working with?
2.
Okay, so Raspberry Pi 2. And that's the one that has 512 meg of memory?
Or is that 256?
1 gig. Oh, it's got a gig. Okay, yep. All right, you're right. I'm thinking about, I've got B. This only got 512. 2, and then 3 now has 1 gig of memory. Mm-hmm. And I like that it's got built-in wireless, and they've gone, and the Model 2 uses the micro SD. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So what OS did you guys run on your Raspberry Pi? Are you using Raspbian or some other OS?
Well, we actually still have, we've been experimenting.
Okay.
We've tried a lot of different OSs. At one point, it pains me to say it, but at one point, and this was my idea, so we put Windows IoT on it.
Okay.
That was
Yeah.
a but
I bet that was
anyway.
interesting.
Yeah, it was something. We didn't really get a whole lot of usefulness out of it. They have a ways to go with that endeavor, but bless them, Microsoft, they're trying, I suppose. But we, for the most part, used Raspbian, just what it came with. It works very well.
Okay.
There's a reason they chose it as the default operating system. It runs very well. We turned off the graphical user interface for the most part. But that actually leads me to one of the advantages that the Raspberry Pi has over an Arduino, and that's its ability to display it to a monitor.
Right.
That's actually huge because in the manufacturing industry, often you have a monitor on the production line, and that's outputting all sorts of data to the operator. And that's very important to have. That's something that actually the HMI and PLCs that cost tens of thousands of dollars to get, not just to get, not even install.
Right.
They don't do that. They actually they stream data to a server, and that server then puts that data into a sort of a graphical interface, and then that is streamed to a website, an IP address, and you have to have a desktop PC actually access that IP address through a web browser. And so you've just got a PC sitting there displaying a web page with laggy information.
Okay, and I just want to mention here for those that don't know, Raspbian is a flavor of Linux that's been kind of scaled down specifically for the Raspberry Pi devices.
Right. So using Raspbian, it works out of the box. Display works out of the box. Everything works out of the box. So more than anything, we've been using that. Although we're tinkers, so we've tried a lot of other things. We've tried the Ubuntu, their version of it.
Right.
What are some of the other ones we tried? We tried a lot of things.
We tried the Fedora version at one point.
Yeah. But anyway, we found that Raspbian it works very well.
Yeah.
There's not a whole stray away from that.
Awesome. And then, as I understand, you guys wrote it in Python. Julie, you did most of the programming on that and wrote that in Python?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, so how did you go about choosing Python? I guess it's pretty much it's kind of become a de facto standard in a lot of ways. A lot of people use it now for data science, even as opposed to the R programming language. And jokingly, I saw in the UK that they're actually teaching Python as a foreign language instead of teaching French and other languages. What do you think about that? That schools replacing foreign languages with computer programming languages.
I think both are important and both need to be taught, but I really don't think one can replace the other.
Okay. And I agree with that because I think for us to have kind of a cultural awareness of the world, we've got to be able to go outside of our digital realm, so to speak. But, I think very much in the future, we're all going to have digital personas that probably are more prevalent than our in the flesh persons because of the way the world is going. How long have you been doing Python? I suppose you've been using it for some of your physics and chemistry projects, and that's what started it.
Yeah, let's see. I've been programming in Python about 2 years now.
Okay.
Originally got into it for physics, computational physics, just data analysis, that kind of thing. And really for controlling GPIO pins, it's either Python or C.
Right.
And I just like Python better than C for smaller scripting things like this.
Right, but you've also done some scripting in C,
I
and well, not
did
scripting, programming.
program. I could do Java, C++, C, and Python.
Now, were those courses that they teach at Erskine, or were those things that you acquired on your own through self-study?
Java, I learned in high school.
Okay.
C++, I took a computational physics class at Erskine, and Python, I taught myself.
Okay. Yeah, and if somebody were trying to learn Python, what do you think is the best approach? Is it looking at small Python programs, what they do, and disassembling them, and or what's the really what do you think approach for somebody to learn Python would be?
Definitely just getting a small program, playing around with the code, figuring out what each line does. That's more or less how I learned.
Okay.
And Julie actually turned me on to a website called, was it the Code Academy
Code
one for
Academy.
Python?
Good site, yeah. I'll put a link to that on. I do the program notes afterwards on my website. That's pseudo companion to the podcast, and I'll put that. I'll put a link to the Code Academy out there because that's. I've taken some of the stuff out there.
That's very useful. That's how I've been learning. Yeah, that's good.
And then also, if you watch Udemy.com, occasionally you'll see a Python course for free. And I usually snatch those up. And then try to find spare time to try to learn things I haven't learned yet. And I used to be pseudo proficient in Python. I've gotten away from it because my day job gets in the way of what I really want to do. So, what research did you do before you kind of took the approach that you did?
Well, I'm not sure what Carlos did, but I remember after J term, his internship was in, he just came bursting into the office we have in the science building saying, "I have a great idea. Let's use Raspberry Pis to change the manufacturing industry."
Oh, yeah, see, I like that. Okay.
So the research was basically observing all that Julie could do with these pies, and I said, "Hey, that's extremely useful in ways that we hadn't thought of yet." And so kind of it really became a piggyback thing off of Julie's previous cluster research.
Now, what did you connect to your Raspberry Pi as far as using the pinouts? What did you have to connect as far as gadgets or boards in order to be able to try to? Now, if I understand correctly, now you need to explain this. So you're sorting marbles based on colors.
Based on whether they're transparent or
That's
opaque.
right. Okay. And how did you accomplish that?
I can go into the hardware.
Yep, you do the
Okay.
hardware, I'll do the software.
So when you look at an opaque marble or a solid marble, basically the easiest way to tell the difference is there light coming through it or not? So what we did is we set up an LED inside of a base. And opposite the marble of that LED, we set up a photoresistor. And so when a solid marble came in, it'd block all the light. And the photoresistor's resistance would, what was it? It would skyrocket. Didn't want to get that backwards. And so that's basically how the sensor worked. If we had a clear marble, there would be less light, and so it would know that there is a marble in there. And when it had the maximum light, the full light of the LED, it would know that there's no marble in there, so it wouldn't do anything, which is what we want. And so the Raspberry Pi, the out input output pins are digital only. So they don't, they have thresholds. You have a high and a low. And so those pins read out, or well, they read highs and lows, ones and zeros. And so we needed a way to turn this variable voltage from the photoresistor into pulses that the Raspberry Pi would then be able to decipher and say, okay, there's this much resistance based on the pulses that I'm getting. And so what we did is we took, we made a modulator. It was a MCP 1008 was the heart of
3008.
3008,
Okay.
was the heart of this modulator. And basically, what you have is you're using a method called pulse width modulation. And so you set up this chip basically to vary the width of pulses that it sends out. And by width, I mean it'll send out a high signal and sustain it for a varying amount of time. And the longer it sustains that high signal, the wider that pulse is seen as. Think of seeing the highs and the lows on an oscilloscope. And so with this varying voltage coming from the photoresistor, the MCP3008 would send out these varying width pulses. And so that's kind of the end of my road. Although our roads kind of merge into one another, this is where Julie comes in, and she starts writing software that recognizes these pulses and assigns a numerical resistance value to these varying widths of pulses. So now we have an interface between an analog, so very smooth sine wave sort of signals, to a digital, the Raspberry Pi, where it's just up, down, square wave, high, low. And so I suppose it'd be appropriate for Julie to talk about the software that she wrote for
Yeah,
that.
definitely.
Yeah, so the first part of the script was just getting that high-low signal, taking it, converting it to some sort of number. And once I got that number, it was a lot of testing just to see if I have a solid marble here. Here's the range of numbers that my program gives me. Here's the range of numbers a clear n a marble gives me. And then it was just a matter of making an if-else statement. If, the number I'm getting from this circuit that Carlos built is in this range, then it's a solid marble. Then if it's in this range, it's a clear marble. So really the script, I believe, to control the whole thing was less than 200 lines.
Oh, wow.
So it was not that hard to write the script.
Well, I gotta think that it took a while to cipher out the logic, though. That's awesome. I'm trying to figure out, convert it to numbers and then do the comparisons. And wow, that's awesome work. Very, very cool. Now, I suppose when you're thinking about what your futures hold, that the programming and technology, even though you pretty much can't major in anything these days without technology being a part of it. Even if you're just doing an English degree, you've got to have computers to be able to do writing. But definitely for physics and chemistry, and definitely mathematics, programming comes into being such an important piece to be able to do the data science, to be able to do the comparisons and that type of thing. How do you think that's going to help you going forward after you get out of your major and you move into like you're going to graduate school and you're moving on to a job or hopefully a profession. I don't wish a job on anybody. So what do you think going forward? What's how you think it's all going to tie in?
I'm definitely looking into going to a graduate program that has computational physics as an
Awesome.
option for a PhD. So de definitely computer science is going to be a part of my future.
Wow. Yeah, definitely. If you had to do it again, do you think you'd go on computer science instead, or you think very much because your primary interest is in physics?
I think I would probably still pick the same route. I like computational physics because it's a nice mixture of, computer science and the physics that I enjoy.
And I apologize, where do you plan on doing your PhD at?
I don't know. I have 2 more years to figure that out.
Okay, all right. I didn't know if you thought maybe you already had a school in mind. So, okay. Now, tell me about the Raspberry Pi cluster that you've built. What
Yeah, so first,
led you to do that? And was it just let's see if we can do this? And then how do you connect those up?
more or less, my freshman year, I took a computational physics class, which was more or less learning C++. And I already knew Java from high school, so it was just learn the syntax. I had it down in a couple weeks. So the professor was more or less just trying to keep me occupied. So he said, "Here's a couple chapters in the book. Pick a chapter and, keep yourself occupied for the last month of class." And one of the chapters happened to be on parallel computing. And I didn't have, the money to buy 5 or 6 computers, but I was able to get funded for 4 Raspberry Pis.
Oh, wow.
They're not as powerful as a real computer, but same concepts are there.
And so their communication is strictly their the cluster inner cluster well the inner node communication is over network, or do you have to use the pinouts to connect them up?
Ethernet.
And I guess the question is they all kind of go together, kind of create like a virtual IP address so you can address them, and is it like a load balance type thing where or a round robin approach where each one jumps in and does part of the computation, or how exactly did that work?
depends on the program. You write the program to, depending on what you're trying to solve, whether they all do a little piece or
Okay.
how exactly the work is split up.
Okay. Wow, that is really interesting. I saw like a 25 node Raspberry Pi cluster, and they took Lego blocks to build a case, so to speak, to put them all together. It was a guy and his young son were working together to try to do a Raspberry Pi project. Granted that didn't, I don't remember them mentioning that they actually had anything really interesting to do computations with, but that's really interesting. Now, so we're very much in information age. I'd say we've probably been in it for a while. What do you think it would take to get, kids and get more people involved in technology? The issue we're having is that we actually have a shortage of computer science professionals, and the thing is that people just don't realize that technology is a part of every job. And I see a day when, artificial intelligence and robots kind of take over the factory, and the guy that stays employed, the person that stays employed, is the one that knows how to fix the robot, or the one that knows how to program the artificial intelligence. And so I'm concerned we're going to have a world, the digital divide is going to get bigger and bigger. How can we get more people involved in technology? What do you think it takes to interest people?
You want to talk about the electronics club?
Sure. Well, Charles Angel, the mayor of Due West, he started an electronics club for the kids of the in the area of Due West, the thriving metropolis of Due West. And it's neat in its approach because it doesn't beat around the bush. It doesn't give them all the fun things without showing them all the technical things. So really, it's a stretch, I'll admit, our approach. But the kids are really, they're shown how these devices actually work, which is cool because for me growing up, I kind of didn't have a whole lot of interest in studying anything because it's like, oh, well, you're just telling me a bunch of things, but you're giving me a lot of analogies, but I know that's not really how it works. So, I wasn't engaged because I was starting to wonder if they knew how it worked. Turned out they didn't. But it's really neat to be able to fully level with these kids and say, look, this is how it works. We got to break it down. Otherwise, you're not going to understand. But once you do understand, it's an amazing thing. And it works because they walk away with a fundamental understanding, but also because it's not this magical thing that they're never going to obtain. It's not this thing that nobody understands except for a select few geniuses. It makes it attainable. Although it can be really frustrating for them to sit down and have to learn these fundamental things, so it's neat in that approach, and I think that's really what is necessary to not make it an easy thing. It's not, when you get
Right.
down to it, it's not easy.
No. It's not like there's open source plans on the internet for how to make your own CPU, but the average person's not going to go seek out and, oh, I got to go build a CPU before I can get started. But they may need to understand about how memory works and communication to the CPU, the North Bridge and the South Bridge and that type of thing, to understand how basic computer works, or how, I'm plugging up this USB cable, and what's the conversion, where it's converting things to ones and zeros so that the CPU can process it, and how does the video card work, and that type of thing. So I think I
So
like
it's a
the whole
lot more.
process of breaking it down. And is that you think that's what really works, is breaking it down in the smallest pieces?
I think so because it's not this mystical, unattainable knowledge. It's within reach. It's a long reach, and it's going to take a lot of work to get to it. But it's within reach, and it's taking the fog away from it. It's not teaching a kid how to use a computer by touching an iPad. That's just like, okay, well, I know if I do this, it'll react in this way, and that's cool, but I have no idea what's going on. That's, yeah.
That's a frustrating thing for me, is I'll run into people who are perfectly happy that if I can just run an application on the iPad, that's awesome, and they don't care how it works, what it has to do to communicate in the background to make those things happen, and the process of creating the application. And I know that's not for everybody, but I've always wanted to know, how did this all come into being? All the pieces, parts, I've got to know from start to finish. So that's awesome. I think that's great. So your final exam question is, where do you guys see yourselves in 5 years?
About halfway done with grad school.
Halfway done with grad school. And yourself, Carlos?
Well, my future is a little uncertain. There's the job thing. You said you wouldn't wish that on anybody, and I'm in full agreement. I have job offers from a few companies, and they're great. Don't get me wrong, but eventually, I would like to be able to develop and design my own hardware.
Oh, awesome.
As far as just trinkets, devices, suspension components for bicycles. I'm an avid mountain biker. Robotics for manufacturing. I just like robots. Who doesn't? They're cool, right? So I would really like to be able to take up the reins and lead something in the direction that I believe is appropriate, not just, profit oriented. Although profit's fine. 5 years, probably I'll be working in a manufacturing industry, building capital, and hoping to start fund a startup.
And what do you guys think about the startup ethos is kind of out there now? Everybody comes up with an idea and then goes through the process of trying to create a business around that idea, and then they go for the angel funding or venture capital funding to try to get that idea off the ground. You guys think you have ideas that you're going to eventually turn into a startup? I mean, what do you were mentioning about wanting to start your own business, your own company with your own ideas.
Well, Julie's a researcher at heart. Am I right in saying that? But she's also, I say this begrudgingly, she's smarter than I am. I learn by beating on things. She can read things. It's amazing to watch Julie work, and learn. And so I personally would like to be able to fund Julie and her research, because I know that funds dry up. I mean, look at NASA. People just aren't interested, right?
Unfortunately.
Right. So we want the Obama cell phone instead of the NASA program, which to me is outrageous, but we need funding, for researchers, and I know that that's where Julie's passion lies, is researching and breaking ground.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say I don't know who said it, but the person that said that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Yeah, I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. There's so much to learn from everybody else, and when we stop learning, we stop living.
You're in the
So,
wrong
yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'm not the smartest person in the room either. I have to read the dummies book so I can then go and read the technical book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I'm not ashamed to admit that, because that's the process it takes for me. But then it's what you do after you've read the advanced book that shows whether any of that was worth that effort. And so research is awesome, because that's where the most amazing discoveries come about, and ideas that have never been tried get put to test. And so yes, I hope great success for both of you, and really appreciate you guys taking the time out to be on the podcast. Do you guys have any closing thoughts?
Well, I think, I don't know, this is just on my mind as we close up. Go out there and do your own research and fund researchers. I mean, they're really the ones that are pushing us forward. You want a faster iPad? You need Julie's.
Yeah. Without physics, those ones and zeros just won't make that path.
And just You don't have to have a lot of money to do something cool. We did this whole project on a $40 grant from the chemistry department, so.
Ooh, tell them about the benchmark against your super expensive laptop.
Oh, yeah.
And so I benchmarked my cluster that cost $200 against my $800 laptop, and the cluster beat it. The time
Walk
to run a
circles
program
around it.
was half of what it took to run on my laptop.
Wow.
So if you can connect things correctly, write a good enough program, you don't need a lot of money to do something really awesome.
Yeah, wow, that's awesome. Now, of course, what OS are you running on your laptop?
At the time, Windows that has since been remedied.
Okay. Oh, so you're running Linux now? What flavor of Linux? Ubuntu or what?
Ubuntu 14.04.
Okay. Yep. I had an older Mac that, of course, Apple dropped off on the side of the road as far as updating the OS. So I repartitioned it, and I've got a dual boot between Ubuntu and Mac OS. So my kids run Minecraft on the Ubuntu side. So awesome, guys! Thank you so much for being on the program, and I'll give you a shout out when it goes live, and it'll probably be live tomorrow because
Fantastic.
I have a little bit of time. Sometimes I'll record it and it'll take me 2 weeks to get back to it and get time to edit it down. But thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope you guys both great success in your endeavors. And in 5 years, call me up. I'll still be around. So let me know how it works out.
Yes,
Super.
sir. Thank
All
you.
right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the One-Off Technology Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. Don't forget where you parked your car. Until next time, see you.